need to improve it. And as Christians, we are, we're responsible for, we are all held to a benchmark as well. And I think most of us are familiar with the book of Corinthians where it says everyone will stand before the Lord and he will receive, I think it's the fruit of the works that they have done. So we hold ourselves to a benchmark too, but that benchmark is different in that where the world benchmarks by, let's say, money or position or power or assets or personality or whatever it is, we hold ourselves to the benchmark of God's standards. We hold ourselves to the benchmark of do we love God, do we serve God, and Jesus kind of gave us, when you boil that down, the two principles that we benchmark by. Do we love the Lord our God with all our heart and with all our soul and with all our mind? And do we love our neighbors as ourselves? And those are basically the two things that we use to benchmark ourselves. So as I was reading through the Old Testament a couple weeks ago, I was reading about David. Of course, David is an encouraging guy to study. There's a lot there that you can learn, both from his mistakes and from the things that he did and the Psalms that he wrote and the things that he did as the king, both good and bad. And then I got to the life of his son Solomon and started reading through it and started learning a little bit more and forcing myself to dig in and try to understand this stuff better. And I got to the end of Solomon's life and I was really kind of startled and amazed at what Solomon did, because I had always thought of King Solomon as somebody that was a great man of God that did all these wonderful things and was a real blessing and encouragement. And as I started to kind of peel back, looking at just the surface of his life, I was really stunned and kind of dismayed at what happens towards the end of his life. And I had never really thought about it. So Pastor asked me to speak, and I told him this is where I was at and what I was thinking about. And this is what I wanted to teach you about, because ultimately, at the end of the day, we hold ourselves to that benchmark that I talked about earlier. And it's easy to judge King Solomon on the basis of all of those other worldly benchmarks that we talked about before. I mean, obviously, Solomon was a wise man. He was one of the wisest in the world. He had an incredible amount of money, which God blessed him with, and we'll see that as well. He was obviously the king of Israel, so power was no problem for him. Whatever he wanted, he could do. And in fact, we think he did do. And he matches up by all of those worldly benchmarks. And you sit back and you look at it and you say, wow, I mean, Solomon is a great guy and I want to be like Solomon. But then you start looking again a little bit harder and you say, maybe not. Maybe there's some things in Solomon's life that I need to measure myself against to make sure, number one, that I am doing some things appropriately, and number two, that I'm not making some of the mistakes that Solomon did. So I want to go ahead and I want to kind of give a brief biography of Solomon this morning. And we're going to start off in a book that I think most people probably do not spend a lot of time in. It's the Book of Chronicles. And I'm actually going to start at the end of the first Book of Chronicles and go into the second Book of Chronicles, and we're also going to be flipping around between Chronicles and Kings. So if you have a business card or a spare handout, or even the little handout with the hymn lyrics on it, you may want to take that and drop that into the Book of 1 Kings at the very beginning, because we will be flipping back and forth. Towards the end, we'll be spending a lot more time in Kings, because that's where it talks about the end of Solomon's life a little bit more. So you may just want to do that and have that ready to go. So I want to start out first in the book of 1 Chronicles towards the end. And David is actually giving his final charge to Israel. And it starts in starts earlier in the book, but I'm going to pick up at chapter 28 where it says that David assembled at Jerusalem all of the officials of Israel, the officials of the tribes, the officers of the divisions that served the king, the commanders of the thousands, commanders of hundreds, the stewards of all the property and the livestock of the king and his sons, together with the palace officials, his mighty men, and all the seasoned warriors. And King David rose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brothers and my people. I had in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. And I made the preparations for the building, but God said to me," in verse 3, You may not build a house for my name, for you are a man of war and have shed blood. Yet the Lord God of Israel has chosen me from all my father's house to be king over Israel forever. For he chose Judah as the leader, and in the house of Judah, my father's house, and among my father's sons, he took pleasure in me to make me the king over all Israel. And of all my sons, for the Lord has given me many sons, he has chosen Solomon, my son, to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. And he said unto me, it is Solomon your son who shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Now, as we all know, David, of course, had many wives and many children, and God had providentially chosen Solomon to be the next king of Israel. And Solomon's rise to power is actually very abrupt. If you look back in 1 Kings, we know that David had four oldest sons, and the first son was Absalom, who of course led a rebellion against David and was killed. There was a second son named Amnon, who was killed by Absalom for some other things that had happened on. There was a third son named Chileab, who is basically mentioned and then not mentioned anymore, and we don't think that he actually made it to adulthood. And then there's the fourth son, and the fourth son's name was Adonijah. And if you're looking at 1 Kings chapter 1, you'll see the story of Adonijah playing out rather quickly here. It starts off in chapter 1 and verse 1 with, now King David was old and advanced in years, and though they covered him with clothes, he could not get warm. Therefore his servants said to him, let a young woman be sought for my lord the king, and let her wait on the king in being his service, and let her lie in your arms so that the Lord your king may be warm. So we know David is an old man. He's having a hard time retaining his body. He's probably getting sick a lot because he can't stay warm. So they make an arrangement so that the king's health will not be endangered. And as David is dealing with his various physical infirmities, Adonijah comes into power. But Adonijah does it in a way that God didn't really want him to, or that David apparently didn't even want him to, because it says in verse 5, now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father, who was David, the son of Haggith, isn't he? His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done thus and so? And he was a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. And he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest. And they followed Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, and Shimei and Rei, and David's mighty men were not with Elijah. And in verse 9 is where Adonijah basically, he makes a power play. He makes a coup d'etat here, an attempt. He sacrifices sheep and oxen and fattened cattle by the serpent stone, which is beside En-Rogel. And he invited all his brothers and the king's sons and all the royal officials of Judah, but he did not invite Nathan and Benaiah, or the mighty men, or Solomon, his brother. Okay, so what's happening here? Adonijah has decided he is going to be the king after David. And he has brought all of his people together, and he has recruited some of David's helpers, some of David's assistants. One of them is Joab, who was David's general and was in charge of his armies. So Joab brought in a significant portion of the military to back this coup attempt. And he also brought in the man, Abiathar, the priest, who had been with David, who had defected to David when David was at war with the house of Saul, who had brought David the ephod and had served David as the priest. So Adonijah has made preparations, and he is going to seize the throne. Now, what's interesting here is that he does not have the support of Zadok the priest, or Benaiah, or David's mighty men. So there's a faction. And what should be altogether united under David's reign has now been split. And half of these people are following after him. And in verse 10, I think it says, and he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaiah, or the mighty men, or Solomon his brother. What I think is happening here, Adonijah is making a play for the throne. And in those days, and typically what you see with coup attempts, is that if there's any competition to the throne after you seize it, they don't last very long. And typically what happens is they're executed. And Nathan the prophet finds out, and we're going to pick up in verse 11 of 1 Kings chapter 1, and it says, Nathan says to Bathsheba, the son of Solomon, have you not heard that Adonijah has become king and David our Lord does not know it? Now therefore come, let me give you advice that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go in at once to King David and say to him, did you not, my lord the king, swear to your servant, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? Why then is Adonijah king? Then as while you are still speaking with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words. And that's what happens. Bathsheba goes in, she says to David, David, we've talked about this. I know that your plan has always been that Solomon would be the king after me. And yet now this son of yours, Adonijah, he's holding a temple feast. He's got the priests there. He has the backing of the military. Can you please clarify for me what your intentions are? So she does. She goes in to David. She tells him the story. As she's still in the middle of telling the story, Nathan comes in, Nathan the priest, he also reiterates the story. And in verse 28, after Bathsheba recounts the affair to King David, and Nathan recounts the affair to King David, King David answers in verse 28, and he says, Bathsheba, came into the king's presence and stood before the king, and the king swore, saying, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, as I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, even so will I do this day. And that's exactly what happens. Bathsheba thanks David and for remembering his oath and for fulfilling it that day. David does have King Solomon installed on his throne. The news of Solomon now taking the kingship is relayed to Adonijah in verse 41. All of Adonijah's power falls apart, basically. Adonijah runs for his life. In verse 50, he arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar, and then it was told to Solomon, behold, Adonijah fears King Solomon, for behold, he has laid hold on the horns of the altar, saying, King Solomon, swear to me first that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. Solomon makes a wise decision here. If he will show himself a worthy man, basically if he behaves himself and he doesn't try this again, none of his hairs shall fall to the earth, but if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So Solomon pardons him. And Solomon has been established as the king, but as we look at where we're at in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 28, this is the second coronation. This is the public coronation. This is so that there is no confusion anywhere with anybody in the nation that David has indeed appointed Solomon to be king. And as David is giving this charge to Israel in chapter 28, he lays out two tasks for Solomon. He opens up with his prayer. He reiterates in verse 6 that Solomon will build the temple of the Lord and that God will establish his kingdom if he continues strong in keeping my commandments and my rules as he is today. And he says in verse 8, now therefore in the sight of all Israel, the assembly of the Lord, and in the hearing of our God, observe and seek out all the commandments of the Lord your God, that you may possess this good land and leave it for an inheritance to your children after you forever. And you, Solomon, my son, in verse 9, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind, for the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. And if you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. So David charges him with two tasks. And the first task is to know the God of your fathers and to serve him with a whole heart and a willing mind. And I want to spend a couple minutes on this because it's really important. One of the things that I had been thinking about many months ago, was what we call the Shema, Deuteronomy 6. I think most of you are familiar with it. Let me go ahead and flip there to it very quickly, and I'll just read it to you. It is, as I said earlier, one of the first and greatest commandments. Moses gave it to the Israelites when they were preparing to enter into the promised land. He's ready to lay down most of the laws that they need, and he starts off with this in chapter 6 and verse 1 of Deuteronomy. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land which you are going over to possess it, so that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all of his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall hear the, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. And, folks, I struggle with this so much. I really do, because I know it, and you have the intellectual assent that, yes, I need to love the Lord your God with all my heart and soul and mind, with every fiber of my being. And it's just, it's so important. It's so critical. It's one of those two benchmarks, like I said, that we need to live our lives by. And it's so easy, at least for me, to do everything else, you know, to find something else that needs to be done. And you know, you have your priorities and you're trying to set yourself right, and you get busy, and at the end of the day, you realize you've kind of gone through your day, you've gone through your week, you've gone through your month, whatever it is, and you realize you haven't loved the Lord your God with all your mind, all your heart, and all your soul, and all your being, because you've been so busy with everything else, you know? And I find it interesting, the very first thing that David says to his son in public at his coronation ceremony is, be careful to seek the Lord and to love him. You know, and we talk about the New Testament, and there's all of the things that we do in the New Testament. And even when Christ was on earth, people were like, well, what's the most important thing? What can I do? What does it that God really wants from me? And Jesus goes back to this passage again in Deuteronomy. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. So it's very important here that David charges him with this first task. And that's, like I said earlier, that's a benchmark that we have placed on us. And that's not something you can measure by any kind of earthly standard. It's not like gold. Oh, I've accumulated, you know, $10,000 in my savings account, therefore I'm right with God, you know? No, because we live as spiritual beings, and we dwell in a physical earth, but we have a spiritual reality that we're all hold to. That spiritual reality is to love the God, love our Lord. So David continues in chapter 28. In verse 11, he gives him the second task that David charges him. David gave Solomon his son the plans of the vestibule of the temple, and of its houses, and its treasuries, its upper rooms, and its inner chambers, and of the room for the mercy seat, and the plan of all that he had in mind for the courts of the house of the Lord, all the surrounding chambers, all the treasuries of the house of God, and the treasuries for dedicated gifts, for the divisions of the priests, in verse 13, all the work of the service, verse 14, the weight of gold for all of the golden vessels, the weight of the silver vessels for each service, the weight of the golden lampstand. I mean, David supplies everything that he could possibly do so that Solomon could build this house of the Lord. And we're not going to talk about it quite yet, but when you start going through and reading the measurements and the amount of things that David gave to Solomon, or that Solomon accrues himself, it is lavish. It is, I would say, excessive, except there's nothing too excessive for the temple of the God, of our God. The quantities, I'm sitting there and I'm trying to measure this stuff out in earthly measures. You know, we use pounds and tons and things like that. And I'm just like, what do you do with all this gold? You know? I'll give you a quick example. Chapter 29, verse 4. Actually, I'll start in verse 3. Moreover, in addition to all I have provided for the Holy House, so in addition to everything I personally have given for the temple, I have a treasure of my own of gold and silver, and because of the devotion to the house of my God, I give it to the house of my God, 3,000 talents of gold. Now, one talent is about 75 pounds, okay? So, 3,000 times 75, you're talking about a lot of gold. The gold of Ophir. So this isn't just regular gold. This was the finest gold that they knew of at the time. And it was obviously very expensive. And he gives 3,000 talents of it and 7,000 talents of refined silver. What else is there? And then after David talks about all of the stuff that he gathered, they collect a freewill offering in verse 7. This is the freewill offering from the leaders of the fathers' houses. And they gave for the service of the house of God 5,000 talents and 10,000 darics of gold. And a daric is a coin weighing about a quarter of an ounce or about 8 grams. So you've got all of that gold and 10,000 talents of silver and 18,000 talents of bronze and 100,000 talents of iron. And whoever had precious stones gave them to the treasury of the house of the Lord in the care of Jehiel the Gershonite. And the people rejoiced because they had given willingly, for with a whole heart they had offered freely to the Lord. David the king also rejoices greatly. They collect this offering. David prays. They anoint Solomon the king at the end of 1 Chronicles. And then David passes on the seed. And now Solomon is the king. And as I can tell, as I'm reading about the life of Solomon, it sounds like Solomon got off to a really great start. We'll pick up in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, in verse 5. Moreover, the bronze altar that Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, had made, was there before the tabernacle of the Lord, and Solomon and the assembly resorted to it, and Solomon went up there to the bronze altar before the Lord, which was at the tent of meeting, and offered 1,000 burnt offerings on it. Now, I put a little note there on the sermon notes. I took this offline. The website is there because there's a lot of different kinds of offerings in the Old Testament. Some of them you gave to atone for your sins. Some of them you gave because you were worshiping the Lord and you wanted to give back to the Lord some of what he gave to you. Some of it was because there might be unintentional sin in your life that you didn't know about. So you would give this offering to the priests and they would offer it up so that your sins would be forgiven. Now, a burnt offering, as this website defined it for me very quickly, was a voluntary act of worship. It was also for atonement for unintentional sin in general. There's a couple different kinds of offerings for unintentional sin. Or as an expression of devotion, commitment, and complete surrender to God. And the details varied. People who were wealthy that could afford, I think, gave an ox. People who were poor, who could not afford, would give doves or pigeons. And Solomon starts off his reign by going up to worship the Lord, and he offers 1,000 of these things. Can you imagine what that must have looked like as Solomon brought, let's say, 1,000 oxen up the hill to be sacrificed? Can you imagine what it would have looked like as the priests went around and made these offerings and what it must have smelled like as the incense from the offerings and the smell of what has actually been offered ascends to God? Can you imagine how pleased the Lord must have been? This is not like some small fee. This is not like dropping $10 in the offering plate. Not that there's anything wrong with that. This is a lavish and expensive and a real outpouring of wealth, of worship to the Lord. And verse 7 it says, "And that night God appears to Solomon and said unto him, Ask me what I shall give you." Let's think about this here, okay? You're a new king. You apparently have quite a bit of money. Your father is deceased. The kingdom is roughly at rest. There was some turmoil when Solomon came to power, and Solomon dealt with it as best he could, and later on as he needed to. And the Lord appears to him in a vision and says, "Tell me what you want." Now, this is something else that was personally challenging to me. If the Lord appeared to me in a vision, number one, that would be incredible because I've never seen the Lord. Number two, you tell me what you want. Can we take a quick poll around here and ask you guys what you would ask of the Lord if He appeared to you and said, tell you what you want? I'm pretty sure the first thing on my mind would not be, let me be wise and understanding. I think the first thing that would come to my mind would be, well, Lord, if you could take care of my financial needs, I can serve you full time. That would be great. Or, you know, I really just want to make sure that no matter, you don't have to give me a lot of money, but just give me enough to cover my needs. Or, you know, I have this relationship with this person and it's really rocky, but I want to make it right and I'm not sure how to go about it. Could you change their heart so that we can reconcile it? And Solomon doesn't do any of that. Solomon, I don't know if he remembers what David had been praying for him. I don't know where this comes from, but maybe it's a measure of the wisdom that Solomon already had, that he asks the Lord for wisdom. In verse 8, 2 Chronicles chapter 1, and Solomon said to God, you have shown great and steadfast love to David my father, and have made me king in his place. O Lord God, let your word to David my father be now fulfilled, for you have made me king over people as numerous as the dust of the earth. Give me now wisdom and knowledge to go out and to come in before the people, for who can cover this great people of yours, for they are great. Interesting. Solomon asks for wisdom and understanding. And the Lord is pleased with this request. You can read more about that again in 1 Kings. God answered Solomon, 2 Chronicles 1 verse 11, because this was in your heart, and you have not asked for possessions or wealth or honor or the life of those who hate you, and have not even asked long life, but have asked for wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may govern my people over whom I have made you king. Now remember, this is God talking. These are my people. You're just the king. They're my people, Solomon. I will give you, in verse 12, wisdom and knowledge. And I will also give you, because you have chosen well, basically, riches, possession, and honor, such as none of the kings who were before you and none after you shall ever have the like. And I think we can say that God has held up his side of the bargain. I mean, even today, when we talk about wise people, who do we compare them to? We compare them to Solomon. The Lord makes two promises to Solomon here. The first one is the riches, the possession, and the honor, such as nobody else will ever have. And then he makes a second promise, and this one I do want to look at, and this is back in the book of 1 Kings. It's a little bit later on in the book. It's chapter 3. And we'll start just where I left off. I will give you what you have not asked, riches and honor, so that no king shall compare with you all your days. And then he makes a second promise, a conditional promise. And if you will walk in my ways and keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Okay, folks, I want you to make a very careful note about this. God promises him all of the other things, and then he says, if you will obey me and follow after my word and seek me with your whole heart, I will lengthen your days. And that's important to note because there's a distinction there. The first one says, I'm going to do this for you anyway. The second one says, I will do this for you as long as you obey me. And if you get, you kind of get the feeling here that there's something coming down the road if you don't know much about the life of Solomon, and you wonder, is this going to happen? And I think eventually you can say that no, Solomon did not do this. Now, back, and I'm going to go a little bit back further now, back to the book of Deuteronomy, but you guys can stay in 1 Chronicles. Back when Moses took the Israelites into the promised land, he was giving them the commands of the Lord. And one of those commands was that when the people of Israel were established in the land, they would ask for a king. And this is many, many years, of course, before David. And he says in chapter 17, verse 14, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. Now remember, it wasn't supposed to be this way. It was supposed to be a theocracy. The people would go to the priests would intercede for them at the Lord would give the nation wisdom. But Israel went into the land, took over the land, and asked for a king, because Samuel had gotten old, his sons were corrupt, there were problems, and the people wanted a king that they could be like all the nations around them. So God is telling them way in advance, you guys are going to ask for a king, and when you have a king, this is what I want the king to do. Actually, this is what I want the king not to do. One who is among your brothers shall you set as king over you. This is Deuteronomy 17:15. You may not put a foreigner over you, one who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. Now that last phrase, we say, okay, Solomon did that, but yes, God gave him that. So this is the one condition out of all the rules that the Lord has set down that God himself has fulfilled. He said, you can't go out and accumulate gold for yourself, but if I choose to bless you with it, then there's no problem. And in verse 18, and when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in the book a copy of this law approved by the priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of the law and his statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. I find it interesting in this passage that we don't have any record of Solomon actually doing that. Now, I'm not saying this is basically an argument from silence. We have no evidence that he did, but we don't have any evidence that he did it either. And I find it especially interesting in this Deuteronomy passage because if, and this is just my conjecture here, if he did write himself a book of the copy of the law, and he did read it all the days of his life, and he did learn to fear the Lord his God, and to keep all of the words of the law and the statutes, then he wouldn't have made the mistakes he did in verses 16 and 17 in acquiring many horses for himself, and especially, he would have known not to acquire many wives, which were eventually his downfall. But that's all coming down in the future. And right now we're back with Solomon in 2 Chronicles chapter 1 and chapter 2. So Solomon starts off his reign by building the temple for the Lord with all of the materials that he's been given. In chapter 2 of 2 Chronicles, now Solomon purposed to build a temple for the name of the Lord and a royal palace for himself. And I'm going to skip over verse 2 real quick, and I'm going to go straight to verse 3. Solomon sent word to Hiram, the king of Tyre, as you dwelt with David my father, and sent him cedar to build himself a house to dwell in, so deal with me. Behold, I am about to build a house for the name of the Lord my God and dedicate it to him. I'm going to skip down a little bit more to verse 7. So now send me a man skilled to work in gold and silver and bronze and iron and purple and crimson and blue fabrics, chained also with engraving, to be with the skilled workers who are with me in Judah and Jerusalem, whom my father David provided. And send me also cedar, cypress, and algum timber from Lebanon. So he makes a pact with Hiram, the king of Tyre, to make sure that he has access to the finest and the best of everything that he can do to build this temple. He wants Hiram to provide him with the technical know-how to make things, how to work the iron and the gold, how to weave and to sew and to embroider and all of the things that needed, all of the engravers to etch the patterns onto all of the walls and the materials and the utensils and the tools that will be used, and he in turn will send to Solomon, or he will send to Hiram, wheat, barley, wine, and oil as food and for consumption. So he makes a pact. Now, Hiram is the king of Tyre, and sometimes we read in the Old Testament, ooh, Tyre, that was a bad place. Hiram apparently was a man who knew the Lord and loved the Lord and was friends with David and supplied him with a lot of the things that he had also needed. So Solomon uses his power as the king to establish a trade rate, a trade route, so that he has access to what he needs to build the temple. He also, and this is where I want to go back to verse 2 in chapter 2, he recruits over 135,000 people to help with building this temple. Solomon assigned 70,000 men to bear burdens and 80,000 to quarry in the hill country and 3,600 to oversee them. Now there, it doesn't say it here, but it does say, I think, in Kings. The stone that they mined was worked at the site. It was not worked at the temple because they didn't want it, the noise, for whatever reason, of the stone being shaped. So that is part of the reason why there's so many of these people. And the other thing that we do know about all of these people is that they were foreigners. They were people from the land that had been, when Saul came to power, Saul was commanded to expel all of these people from the land because they did not worship the Lord, and the Israelites didn't do it, and later they couldn't do it. So Solomon takes all of those people and he puts them to work as his slaves to help with the building of the temple. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a diagram of the temple and I'm not going to talk about how they actually built the temple. But if you want to go in the library at the end of the service today, there's a book out. It's I think it's the Rose Book of Charts and Maps and Atlases or something. There's a page in there and it shows what the temple looks like when it was completed. And to just give you some kind of idea of what the temple would have looked like when you're done, I want to skip ahead and I want to talk about what we call the most holy place or the Holy of Holies. So you can jump ahead to 2 Chronicles chapter 3 verse 8. Now the holy place or the most holy place, I will refer to it as the Holy of Holies, was not a big room. It was, according to verse 8, its length corresponding to the breadth of the house was 20 cubits and its breadth was 20 cubits. So we're talking about something that's roughly 30 feet by 30 feet. And he overlaid this room with 600 talents of fine gold. And the weight of the gold for the nails was 50 shekels, and he overlaid the upper chambers with gold. So he's building the temple and he builds this room. Now this is the Holy of Holies. This is where the Ark of the Covenant is kept. This is where God's presence will dwell. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later as well. And he takes this room that's 30 by 30, I don't know how tall it is off time, and he covers the entire thing with gold. And he uncovers the walls with gold. And inside the Holy of Holies, there were the cherubim. Verse 10. In the most holy place, he laid two cherubim of wood and overlaid them with gold. And the wings of the cherubim together extended 20 cubits. One wing of the one was 5 cubits, touched the wall of the house, and its other wing of 5 cubits touched the wing of the other cherub. And of this cherub, one wing of 5 cubits touched the wall of the house, and the other wing also 5 cubits. So basically, you've got two cherubim with their wings out like this, and the wings are touching each other. This wing is touching the far wall. This wing touches the left-hand wing of the first, and then the second wing touches the other side of the gold. These are made out of wood. These are also engraved. These are also covered with solid gold. Now, if you guys don't know much about gold, like I don't, you start reading about this and you're like, wow, how do you do this? Well, gold is a very soft metal. So you can't just shape it like iron or steel and it'll hold that shape. You have to nail it into place. So what are you nailing? You nail it with nails. Well, you don't use just regular nails. Solomon had the nails that he used either dipped in gold or overlaid with gold, or maybe it was just the heads of the nails. He had those gold plated. So you walk into this room, not that anybody could enter except the high priest on the Day of Atonement, and it is solid gold everywhere you see. And before you can see the cherubim, you have to go in, and Solomon has a veil made, verse 14, a veil of blue and purple and crimson fabrics and fine linen, and he works the cherubim on him. So if you're going into the temple, you go into the temple, you go past the sacrifices, you go into the second part of the temple, which is the holy place, and then you see this enormous veil of blue and crimson and purple cloth with cherubim. And if you could walk into it, again, as I said, only the high priest could go in on certain days, you would go into this room that was solid gold. I mean, as far as we can tell, everywhere was gold. And now you kind of get the feeling that you might understand why Solomon collected so much gold and silver. I mean, this is just the one small room, and it's 30 by 30. The next room out, the holy place, is also overlaid with gold, solid gold. There's a reason why when Israel and Judah get into trouble later, and they're being pillaged and being destroyed by the Assyrians and all of these other nations, what are they doing? They're going into the temple and they're taking the gold out. And it's not because there's a little bit there. They're taking lots of gold out. So that's just to give you some kind of idea what the very insides of this temple would have looked like. And I'm going to skip ahead a little bit further now to chapter 5 of 2 Chronicles. And it says, thus all the work that Solomon did for the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated and stored, the silver and the gold and all the vessels and all the treasuries of the house of God. You continue reading in that chapter. Solomon assembles the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes and the leaders of the houses and the people of Israel. And they come up in verse 6 of chapter 5, and King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. And the priests brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house in the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies, underneath the wings of those two cherubim I just talked about, so that the cherubim made a covering between the ark and the poles, and the poles were so long that the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place from before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from the outside. The ministers come out of the temple, verse 11, and the priests stood east of an outside altar that they used for all these sacrifices. Verse 13, and it was the duty of the trumpeters and the singers to make themselves heard in unison to praise and thanksgiving to the Lord when the song was raised, with trumpets and cymbals and other musical instruments in praise to the Lord, for he is good and his steadfast love endures forever. And the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. Now, you may remember back to the Old Testament, when God led the Israelites out of Egypt, what did he lead them by? It was a pillar of fire at night and a cloud by day. And this cloud that we see is some kind of physical manifestation of the presence of God. And Solomon has built this temple and now has, as my wife reminded me yesterday, a front row seat to the presence of God in this holy temple. Can you imagine what that must have looked like? You're the king of the nation. You have worked with everybody and gathered all of the materials, and you've been intimately involved with every little detail, and you build this temple and you lavish it with gold and silver, and God chooses it and he uses it. And he comes down before you in a physical manifestation. Can you imagine what this must have looked like? I think one of the reasons why it says it was filled with a cloud is because there's no other way to describe it. You know, it's like when you're reading in Revelation and he says, well, I saw the feet and the feet were kind of like bronze, and I saw this and it was kind of like this, and I saw something else, and you know what, let's just go ahead and go there. Here we go. These are the creatures that John saw in chapter 4 and verse 6. And around the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures, full of eyes front and behind. And the first living creature was like a lion. And the second living creature was like an ox, and the third living creature had the face of a man, and the fourth living creature was like an eagle in flight. Can you imagine? I mean, we try and talk about angels, or we try and talk about things, and we try and describe them, we try and, you say, dumb it down and put it in language that we can understand. And Salvin got to see all of this. It's unbelievable. So the cloud comes down and it takes over the temple so that the priest can't even stand and minister. There's another part later on in the book of Second Chronicles where it says, as soon as Solomon finishes his prayer of dedication, fire comes down from heaven and consumes all of the burnt offerings and the sacrifices. And just in case there's any doubt in your mind at all that God is not pleased with this temple, in chapter 7, verse 11, Solomon finished the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all that Solomon had planned to do in the house of the Lord and in his own house he successfully accomplished. The Lord appeared to Solomon in the night and said to him, I have heard your prayer. This is the second time Solomon has been blessed with some kind of manifestation of the Lord. And I have chosen, in verse 12, this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. And when I shut up the heavens that there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, this is the famous prayer, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and I will heal their land. And my eyes will be open and my ears will be attentive to the prayer that is made in this place. Verse 16, for now I have chosen and consecrated this house that my name may be there forever. Okay, this is not like, God's like, well, you know, it's acceptable, I'll take it. I have chosen this place to dwell with my people. And then he gives some more instruction back to Solomon. And this is very similar to that first time that Solomon sees the king. And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne, as I covenanted with David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man to rule Israel. And verse 19, here's that little warning sign again. But if you turn aside and forsake my statutes and my commandments that I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will pluck you up from the land that I have given to you, and this house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. I will make it a proverb and a byword among all the peoples, and this house which was exalted, everyone passing by will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done thus and so to this house? And they will say, because they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt and laid hold on other gods and worshipped them and served them, and therefore he has brought all of this disaster upon them. Let's go ahead and start turning back to 1 Kings chapter 11 here. I found this so interesting as I was preparing the sermon last night. This is the last time that I know of that we have any record of Solomon meeting with the Lord, praying to the Lord, seeking the Lord. And it's not that Solomon doesn't do good stuff. I mean, chapter 8, it says all of the things that Solomon did. He went up and he took cities and he rebuilt them. He fortified cities and made them stronger. He married the Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter, which was something that never happened. The Egyptian Pharaohs never let their daughters marry anybody. But Solomon managed to marry the daughter of the Egyptian Pharaoh. And he offers up offerings like he's supposed to. But in the book of 1 Kings, you get to chapter 11 after the second appearance of God, and it talks about some of the other things that Solomon did. The Queen of Sheba comes and she's totally impressed by Solomon and what he has and his wisdom. And it talks in chapter 10 about the weight of the gold that Solomon collected every year, 666 talents. Again, the talent being about 75 pounds of gold. And you get to chapter 11. Actually, let's start in chapter 10, because remember we talked about in Deuteronomy, you should not go back to Egypt. You should not collect horses from Egypt. In chapter 10, verse 28, Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt. And the king's traders received them at a price from Kew. And a chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. So we know he's building up horses as God told them not to do in Deuteronomy. And you get to chapter 11 and it starts off with King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. He loved Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, and Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after other gods. And what's the next thing that it says there? Solomon clung to these in love. And you have, when you look at the Hebrew, and I'm no Hebrew scholar, the word cling is to lay hold or to seize. And you get the idea that you couldn't drag this person away from this if you wanted to. Their grip is that strong. And when Solomon was old in verse 4, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the God, to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. Folks, this wasn't like a little collection. This wasn't like, okay, you know, we talk about Mormons and the history of polygamy that they have, and they would have, you know, 10 wives. Nope. Solomon has 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. He has 1,000 women. You talk about Solomon, and Solomon was, God blessed him so lavishly. He blessed him lavishly with gold, and he blessed him lavishly with wisdom, and he blessed him lavishly with all of these things. And Solomon went out, and he took that lavishness, and he poured it into sin. And he chased after what God told him not to. And you know what happened? Verse 5, Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow after him as David his father had done. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, verse 7, and for Moloch, the abomination of the Ammonites on the mountains east of Jerusalem. And he did this for all of his foreign wives, who made offerings and sacrifices to their gods. And I'm helping with this website right now, and it's a bulletin board. You get on there and you talk about Christian things. And most of us have seen smiley icons. You know, you put it in your email and it looks like a little happy face with a smiley. And there was one yesterday. I'm looking through the administrator's part of it. And somebody put an icon, I love this icon, and it's a brick wall, and it's this happy smiley face going up, and they're beating their head against the wall like this. Can you get the idea here that I want to beat my head against the wall of this passage? Because it's like, how do you do this? God appears to you in a vision, God ordains you, you have David, the man who loved the Lord with all his heart and soul and mind, and who followed after God and was called the friend of God, and you blow it. You walked away from him. You followed after all of these other gods that people worship after they carve them out of trees. What do you say? What do you say? And the Lord, verse 9, in 1 Kings chapter 11, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. And he did not keep what the Lord commanded. And the Lord said to Solomon, since you have, this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, and I will surely tear this kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. And yet for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. And I will not tear away all of the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. God says, I'm going to take everything away from you, except for one tribe, because I promised your father that you could have it. In verse 14, you see the trouble start to come in the form of external enemies. The Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite, and he was of the royal house of Edom. And you sit there and you go through, and David was an Edom, and Joab had made a raid, and he had slaughtered every male in Edom, and this man escaped to Egypt. And when Hadad hears that David has passed on and Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, he says to Pharaoh, let me depart. Pharaoh says, what have you lacked? What do I need to do for you that you will stay with me and serve me? And he said, the only thing you can do for me is to let me go back to my land. And he did. Pharaoh let him go. So now Solomon has trouble on his southern borders from the land of Edom. But God also raises up another adversary from him. Rezon, the son of Eliada, verse 23, 1 Kings 11, who had fled from his master, and he gathered the men about him and became the leader of a marauding band after the killing by David. And they went to Damascus and lived there and made him king in Damascus. And he was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon, doing harm as Hadad did. And he loathed Israel and reigned after Syria. So now you've got two groups living on your borders that are enemies that God has raised up specifically to afflict you for not obeying his law. And then there's internal strife. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 26, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zerah, a servant of Solomon, note that, also lifted up his hand against the king. Now this is interesting. Verse 27, Solomon built the Milo and closed up the breach of the city of David his father. Basically, I think he rebuilt the walls. And the man Jeroboam was very able, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And at that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now Ahijah had dressed himself, and the two of them were alone in the open country. And Ahijah laid hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces and said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon, and I will give you 10 tribes, but he shall have one tribe for the sake of his servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, because, verse 33, they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the Ammonites, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight, keeping my statutes and my rules as David his father did. Solomon finds out about it. Verse 40. And I think this is so interesting because, you know, when Saul was king and God said, David, you will be the king, David never tried to take it by force. David tried to get away from Saul. And later on, God ordained it so that Saul passed away and David became the king. Solomon finds out, so this is a story he's heard about, that Jeroboam is going to be the next king. And what does he do? He sought, therefore, to kill Jeroboam. And Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. For now, the rest of the acts of Solomon and all that he did, chapter 11, verse 41, 1 Kings, and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? And at that time, Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel 40 years, and Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam his son reigned in his place. Solomon's life at this point is over, but I just want to point out one more little footnote here in the book of Kings. King Rehoboam, son of Solomon, chapter 12, verse 6, took counsel with the old men who stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer this people? Because they've come up and they've said, Solomon oppressed us and treated us cruelly. Can you please lighten this yoke that he has placed upon us? It's interesting. They don't talk about the temple. They don't talk about all of the good things that Solomon did. They talk about taking this heavy yoke off of us that Solomon oppressed us with. And I think most of you are familiar with the story. Rehoboam talks to the old men, receives their counsel, go ahead, lighten their load. They will love you. They will serve you forever. Rehoboam then goes to the younger men, and they say, nope, tell them they haven't seen anything yet. Your my little finger will be thicker than my father, and now whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to it. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions, basically whips with multiple tails, like a cat of nine tails, that were even worse. And he takes the advice of the young men, and God tears the kingdom out from under him. Verse 15, for the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word which the Lord spoke by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Now what does this have to do for us? Let me ask you, number one and number two. There's a great book by a Puritan. I don't have the author's name in front of me right now. He talks about what happens when you find sin in your life. And he's encouraging the people that are reading this book to search carefully in your own lives. Search for sin like it might be a small fire. And catch that thing and put it out. Catch that sin and destroy it before it turns into a huge fire that burns your house to the ground and ruins your life. So there's two things that we can see. Number one, what are you, or more importantly, what am I, because I'm the one speaking, what am I harboring that is keeping me from a right relationship with God? What am I clinging after that Solomon, like Solomon, clung to that destroyed his life? And number two, is it something that I'm not aware of, or is it something that I know about? And I keep convincing myself, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. I'll make this right with God someday. Because while you let that sin grow, or while I let that sin grow, it gets bigger, gets stronger, gets more of a hold on you. But it's okay. We'll make it right eventually. Because, you know, we have David for our fathers, or we have the book of the law, or the Lord appeared to me, or the Lord has blessed me with all this stuff. I don't know too much about the Song of Solomon. There's an interesting little quote in there, though, that I had read one time. Let us take now the little foxes that spoil the vines. What little foxes are there? What's in your life? What do you know about? What are you hiding? What are you harboring that God wants you to deal with today? And that's what I think we can take away from the Book of Solomon. Not that Solomon was the king. Not that Solomon had all of this money and all of this power and everything else. But that Solomon had little problems and he didn't listen and he didn't obey and he didn't pay attention and he ruined his life as a result of that.